I'd like to get right into this, so if you would turn to Galatians, the third chapter, Galatians chapter 3. I want to review something that was covered recently, maybe one, two sermons ago, concerning Abraham and his seed, concerning the Abrahamic covenant and the distinction between the Abrahamic covenant and the Sinaitic covenant. You will recall a few weeks ago, whenever it was, that we looked at that and we realized that, or we went over the fact that the Abrahamic covenant is unconditional. The Sinaitic covenant that was made with the children of Israel in the time of Moses was conditional. That is to say, the Israelites had to meet certain conditions in order to receive the promises that were guaranteed in that covenant, guaranteed as long as they met the conditions, that is to say. So you had a conditional covenant, you had one that is unconditional. It is based on the unconditional promises God made to Abraham that we have salvation, because the promise was to Abraham and to his seed. And you will recall we talked about that singular seed of Abraham, meaning Christ. And so the covenant is made with Abraham and with his seed, which is Christ. Now it is sealed. It was sealed with an oath in the time of Abraham. Christ has come. He is now, of course, as at the right hand of God as our high priest. And so the covenant is absolute. The promise to Abraham is absolute. It's fulfilled in him. And our union with him, therefore, makes us children of Abraham. So it's our understanding, therefore, that the true Israel of God, in that sense, is the people of God, whoever they are, Jew and Gentile alike. But you know, there are other elements to the promise given to Abraham that are equally unconditional. I want to look at that today. What we talked about then pertains to salvation, how Jew and Gentile are saved, ultimately having eternal life, entering the kingdom and family of God, living with God and with each other forever. Now there are other items, other facts, other promises within the Abrahamic covenant I want to look at today. And it has to, let's just begin there in Galatians 3. I want to ask some questions about the multiple seed of Abraham. The multiple seed of Abraham. Not just the single seed, which is Christ, but all of those other descendants of Abraham and how this pertains to them. Galatians 3, let's begin in verse 15. To give a human example, brothers, even with a man-made covenant, no one annuls it or adds to it once it has been ratified. Now, the promises were made to Abraham and to his offspring. It does not say, and to offsprings, plural, referring to many, but referring to one. And to your offspring, and Paul explains, who is Christ. So that's the single seed. And he's focusing on salvation here. Keep that in mind. But there's a principle. The principle I want to point to and underscore is the fact that the covenant that came later, the Sinaitic covenant, cannot cancel anything in the previous covenant, the one made with Abraham. The promises God made to Abraham, it cannot cancel it. He said, this is what I mean, and he goes on to explain that very thing. He says, the law which came 430 years afterward does not annul or a covenant previously ratified by God so as to make the promise void. So God made these promises to Abraham. He swore by his own name that they would come about, that he would deliver. And then this other law, this covenant that came later, 430 years later, was made with Israel, could not change that. Even if Israel is unfaithful, even if Israel blows it big time as they did, then it can't change the previous promise that God made. Okay? Verse 18, for if the inheritance comes by the law, it no longer comes by promise, but God gave it to Abraham by promise. So I want to look at the multiple seed of Abraham and see how this principle applies to them by going back, first of all, to Genesis 15. We'll review again some of the scriptures we'd covered previously, but Genesis 15, and you will recall that this is where God made the covenant. He divided the sacrifice, and the torch passed between the divided sacrifices, symbolizing the divine presence. And that's what, as we explained that time, in that particular message, that's what people did in ancient times to confirm a covenant. When they offered the sacrifice, they laid the parts of the body parts of the divided animals on one side or the other, and both parties passed through it. In this case, it was God alone, symbolized by the torch that Abraham saw. The torch, that was the divine presence. It passed between these parts. In other words, ratifying and sealing, confirming forever that his promise is true. And so taking up the account then in verse 17, when the sun had gone down and it was dark, behold, a smoking fire pot and a flaming torch passed between these pieces. Again, symbolizing or representing the divine presence. On that day, the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, to your offspring I give this land from the river of Egypt to the great river, the river Euphrates. Understand that the promise expands beyond that, ultimately, to the whole earth. And then now you get into the single seed and how those who are connected with the single seed, which is Christ, will inherit the whole earth. But this is a particular geographical location. He goes on to describe it as the land of the Kenites, the Kadmonites, the Hittites, etc., etc. And then to expand that promise, let's go on over to chapter 17. This is all the same thing. You get different details from the different times that God appeared to Abraham and reiterated the promise. In chapter 17, verse 1, when Abram was 99 years old, the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, I am God Almighty, walk before me and be blameless, that I may make my covenant between me and you and may multiply you greatly. Then Abram fell on his face, and God said to him, behold, my covenant is with you, and you shall be the father of a multitude of nations. Now, what's he really talking about there? Well, Abraham did become the physical father of many nations. That includes not only the nation of Israel, but also he was the father of the Edomites, the Ishmaelites, and the descendants of his through Keturah. So he literally became a father of many nations in the time that after him. Many nations came from him. No longer shall your name be Abram, but your name shall be called, or shall be Abraham. In Hebrew, that's a term similar to a word meaning many nations, or father of many nations. For I have made you the father of a multitude of nations. I will make you exceedingly fruitful, and I will make you into nations, and kings shall come from you. And I will establish my covenant between me and you and your offspring after you throughout their generations as an everlasting covenant. Now this is talking about, as we shall see, this is the multiple offspring to be God to you and to your offspring after you. And I will give to you and to your offspring after you the land of your sojourning, all the land of Canaan. That's a certain location. That's the promised land. For an everlasting possession, I will be their God. That's multiple seed. And that's a part of the promise. Pertains to the multiple seed. I will be their God. They will inherit this land. I am giving it to you, Abraham. I am giving it to them because they are your seed, your offspring, through, ultimately as we shall see it play out, through Isaac and through Jacob, and then the sons of Jacob. So, you see the promise right there. And that's the Abrahamic covenant. It is not the Sinaitic covenant that comes later. And now then, with all that in mind, it becomes very clear then that those people have a right to the land. And even though God removed the hedge, as it were, because of their covenant breaking, it does not cancel, cannot cancel, the promise given to Abraham. So then, whose land is that even today? Does it belong to the Palestinians? Does it belong? Put it this way, does Israel have a right to exist as a nation? The answer is, yeah, it does. Absolutely does. You know, I could look at it from just a secular point of view and say, of course it does. Has as much right as any other nation, but when I look at it from this point of view, of course they have a right. Those are the descendants of the same people, the 6 million Jews who live in that land today, are the descendants of those same people who came out of the Babylonian exile and resettled the land. Of course that doesn't mean that's all of Israel, because many of them remain scattered. But nevertheless, these were the people who received it then, who went back to the land then, and certainly these are the descendants of the people who did that. So regardless of whether God removes the hedge, whether God punishes the people, whatever happens in that regard, it doesn't mean that now they've lost the land. They may physically lose it when they get driven out, or when the nations come and overtake them and take them out of the land, but that any time they can get back there, they have a right to do that, as I understand this, because it's given to them as an everlasting possession. So, with that in mind, let's go to Matthew chapter 23. And you think, a lot of people think, no, and I think this is people confusing these two covenants. Once the Israelites are driven out of the land, then they have no right to it. That's not true at all. And you wonder, well, is there any evidence then that there will be people descended from Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob living in that land in the latter times? Is there any evidence in the Bible? I say there's an abundance of evidence that they will be. Right there in Jerusalem even. I want you to notice Matthew 23. And in this chapter, Jesus offers this scathing rebuke toward the scribes and the Pharisees. And certainly he doesn't have in mind, that's a subject in itself, perhaps we'll address it sometimes. It's not that all the scribes and Pharisees were wicked evildoers. You know, we use the word Pharisee, you call somebody a Pharisee, that's a bad thing. That's not a compliment. But really, there were many Pharisees who were teachers of the law and were doing a good job and were righteous men. There really were many of them. Nicodemus, that came to Jesus by night, he recognized who he was. Apparently, Joseph of Arimathea was Pharisaic. He was one of the Pharisees. There's the account of the ruler of the synagogue, one of the rulers of the synagogue, who sent for Jesus for a healing. He apparently was a Pharisee. So there were a lot of Pharisees who actually were believers. What they were the teachers of the law. Not the aristocratic Sadducees were the ones compromising with the Roman government. They're the ones who were in it for the position. They were the aristocrats. They didn't go along with the Pharisees. The Pharisees, the Parishim, the people preceding them and leading up to the time of Jesus, are those who wanted to preserve the truth of the Torah in the minds of the people, and so they promoted synagogues where people could come together, worship God, hear the reading of the law, hear it expounded, and so they became experts in the law. Of course, some of them began to get sidetracked and they went off in the wrong direction, just as you see today in, for example, the Roman Catholic priesthood, as you see it in many other churches. They began to get other things, the wrong things in their minds, the wrong motives began to drive them, and they move away from the goal. So you had some of this going on at that time. So Jesus is addressing these Pharisees. You know, some people say, well, this is a very anti-Semitic portion of the scripture. It is not anti-Semitic. Remember, this is a Jew rebuking other Jews. Jesus himself was a Jew. And if he could be identified with any of the parties of Judaism, and he didn't identify with any, but the ones that he would most closely resemble would be the Pharisees. Because they believed absolutely in the ongoing binding nature of Torah. And he did too. And many of the teachings, you look at his teachings in the Sermon on the Mount, for example, and you find some of those same teachings among the Pharisees. So they weren't all bad, but this particular group he's addressing here, and apparently at that time it had become very widespread within the religious community that there was a lot of corruption. And so he addresses them with all these woes and these rebukes. He says, and I'm going to cut down to verse 29, won't read all of it, but just start in verse 29. He says, "Woe to you scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, for you build the tombs of the prophets and decorate the monuments of the righteous, saying, 'If we had lived in the days of our fathers, we would not have taken part with them in shedding the blood of the prophets.' Thus you witness against yourselves that you are sons of those who murdered the prophets. Fill up, then, the measure of your fathers, you serpents, you brood of vipers. How are you to escape the sentence of Gehenna? Therefore I send you prophets and wise men and scribes, and some of whom you will kill and crucify, and some you will flog in your synagogues and persecute from town to town, so that on you may come all the righteous blood shed on earth, from the blood of innocent Abel to the blood of Zechariah the son of Barachiah, whom you murdered between the sanctuary and the altar." What does he mean by that? "It shall come upon you." He's referring to that event, those conditions, and the event leading up to the AD 70 siege of Jerusalem and ultimate destruction of the temple, and thousands of Jews killed in this Roman siege. That's what he's referring to. He says, "Truly I say to you, all these things will come upon this generation." And it did. Within 40 years of the time he said this, these things happened. And then he says, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it." Now this, notice, this is talking about Jerusalem. That place over there, where now it is the capital of Israel, by the way. "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, the city that kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to it, how often would I have gathered your children together as a hen gathers her brood under her wing, and you would not." You were not willing. "See, your house is left to you desolate." He's referring to what's coming down the road when the armies of General Titus would besiege the city and destroy the temple. And then he says this very interesting statement here. He says, "For I tell you, you will not see me again, you who? You Jerusalem, the citizens of Jerusalem, but Jewish citizens of Jerusalem, you will not see me again until..." Oh, you mean they will see him again at some point. "Until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" That implies to me, I realize there are interpreters who interpret this differently, but the plain reading of that suggests that there will come a time when there will be a righteous remnant in the land of Israel, in Jerusalem, will be prepared to meet Jesus Christ at his coming. That's what it tells me. So will there be Jews in the promised land? Yeah. Will they be converted? Will they be messianic? Indeed. Indeed. Believers in Messiah is what I mean by that. Believers in Jesus the Messiah, not some other Messiah. There have been all kind of candidates come along claiming to be the Messiah. But the real one, there's some who embrace him. You know, I was watching a video the other day from a group of, actually they're centered in Jerusalem. They're in Jerusalem. Some of their videos are in Hebrew. You have to read along with it. Others in English. But they're talking about what's going on in Jerusalem as far as Jews believing in Yeshua. That's the way they prefer to pronounce Jesus. Yeshua HaMashiach, Jesus the Messiah. And he made the comment, said, there are fewer than 10,000 right now. But that means there's more than 9,000. You know, it means that, I'm thinking, wow, about nearly 10,000 believers in the Messiah in Jewish Jerusalem. And there are a lot more around the world. And it is a growing movement. It is growing. You know, a lot of these, it's interesting, a lot of them, many of them, some go along with the just typical evangelical stuff, but so many of them, they're not abandoning their Jewish holy days, as people would call them, the holy day, the Sabbath, and things like that. But they see all the Christological meaning in them, and they celebrate them as such. So there you have this going on there. And you know, when people talk about looking at things going on in the world, looking for signs of the end, this, that, and the other, will the beast come from here? Will it come from there? Is this the beast? Is that the beast? You know, the false prophet, what about the, of course, the same as the Antichrist, I suppose. Everybody's trying to play pin the tail on the Antichrist, as Hank Hanegraaff used to say. And, you know, those things don't get me very excited. Those things like that, because that's all speculation, it's guesswork. Always in the past, it turned out to be wrong. And you know, that's why I don't venture to guess when I see something like that. Say, could this be it? But if when I see something like that, when I see that there is a remnant inside that land today, it wasn't all that long ago when the thought of having that many Jewish Christians living in Jerusalem was, you'd think, no, that'll never be. Because, you know, one of the reasons so many Jews reject Jesus is because of the really fine witness of the Christian church. That's one reason, really. We'll talk about that in a few moments. But in any case, these people were the people he's referring to then, and this extends to the Jews today, the descendants of the people who returned from the Babylonian exile, and experienced great trials and tribulations in the many years that followed their return. You know, they had to go through the period of the Assyrian kings. One particularly bad dude was Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, who desecrated the temple, offered swine's flesh on the altar there, and so on. He did all kinds of terrible things. He was devoted to the cause of making Jerusalem into a Jewish cemetery. But then that was during the time of the Maccabean revolt. It didn't work out so well for Antiochus. He died a very miserable death. And so going down to the Roman period, that's the time when Jesus came on the scene. And the Romans were not really all that bad. They were in one way, but they're not in another, because they granted freedom. They said, hey, look, you can have your religion. You can have your holy place. It's weird to us. This idea of an invisible God is really weird. You don't have any idols, but go ahead and do it. We don't care. You know, we have all kinds of gods. Why should we care? So go ahead and do that, and you can have your priesthood, and you can have your customs, and your weird customs, and all of that. So go ahead. All we want is your money, your taxes. Yeah, that's all. That's all we ask for. Yeah, and you do that. Hey, guess what? We'll help. We'll take care of you. We'll keep your roads operational. You know, infrastructure. We have all kind of benefits, and we'll police the area. The bad people that come along, the thieves and murderers, we'll help you out there. And so the Romans were not all that bad, but it was certainly not an ideal situation, because they still were not free and they still had to pay taxes to the Romans. But in any case, they lived through all of that, and then in AD 70, the event there, the terrible, terrible, horrific event that took place, and that was not the end of it, though. That was not the end of it. People think, well, the Jews all left. No, they didn't. No, there was a Jewish presence in that land all along. Always has been. 1948, you know, back when the Jews started returning to Israel to form the nation of Israel, there were already Jewish settlements there. Had been all along. So it's not like they all just left the land. No, there were dreams all during those years, all during this time of wandering. There were dreams in the hearts of many Jews to make it back to the land one day, and one day reestablish themselves as a nation, and hopefully have what they had once before. So that's what you, what I was about to say there was, the AD 70 event was not the end of it. It was not the end of tribulations for the Jewish people living in the land. There was 135, and some people say in some ways it was worse than 70. That was when the Masada event took place. again the Romans and the Jews, the conflict between the two, spearheaded by the Zealots, of course. And but in any case, that was a very bad event. But you know, the Nazarenes that left in AD 70, that's the Jewish Christians, they left before before Titus's armies besieged the city and all the terrible things happened, but they eventually came back. They were there in 135 or about that time. But what happened was the people, and they fought along with the others fighting the Romans. But then when these others, the unbelieving Jews, declared this one particular leader as the Messiah, the Nazarene said, nope, none of that. And they withdrew. They wouldn't fight anymore. And of course, there was a big falling out between the unbelieving Jews and the believing Jews at that point. So basically, they were in no man's land because the Gentiles didn't like them, and now the Jews didn't like them. So that's the legacy of the Nazarenes. And these were the direct descendants of the original Jerusalem church. But in any case, Masada occurred to that event, AD 135. But again, there have always been Jewish settlements in the land, and the scattered Jews retained their identity. They always knew who they were, and they always had that hope of someday returning, at least many of them, not all of them. You know, a lot of Jews today, they've become atheists. They look at their own history and they say, where's God in all that? So they just abandon everything. Others hold to the belief that the God of Abraham is the true God, and they hope to see someday the restoration of Israel. And they hope to see the Messiah come, and, you know, they will. They will. It may not be who they think it is, but in any case, they will. Now, as I mentioned, so often some of the troubles that they'd gone through the centuries has been under the hand of people calling themselves Christians. The word anti-Semitism was coined in Germany in the 19th century. Actually, it's a misleading term in some ways because the Jews are not the only Semitic people. There are other Semitic peoples as well, but it's better than the word that they were using, which is Judenhass, which means Jew hatred. So it's a little bit more, it sounds a little bit better, you know, saying anti-Semitism, better than saying Judenhass or Jew hatred. Jew hatred, of course, is not new. There are lots of good historical sources that can give you an extensive history of this phenomenon. There are all kinds of books on the subject. Even a Wikipedia article. I've got a little quotation here from the Wikipedia, not usually a source that I refer to frequently, but you know, this is I think it was a pretty good summary. Let me read that to you. Pretty good summary in the article Anti-Semitism, and it gives us a good brief overview of the notable instances of persecution of the Jews. It says that these includes, quote, the pogroms which preceded the First Crusade in 1096, the expulsion from England in 1290, the massacres of Spanish Jews in 1391, the persecutions of the Spanish Inquisition, the expulsion from Spain in 1492, I mean, they keep getting expelled from nations, the Cossack massacres in the Ukraine, various pogroms in Russia, the Dreyfus Affair, the Holocaust, of course, official Soviet anti-Jewish policies, and the Jewish exodus from Arab and Muslim countries. And that's to name a few. So these people have been pretty much hated and despised wherever they have been. They've been the scapegoat in some cases. Something bad happens, and who caused it? What's the cause of it? The Jews! It's them! And what happens? Well, sometimes horrible things happen. They've been burned at the stake and all kinds of terrible things. Let me read a little bit from... before I get to that, I'll just mention in passing, mention a few other items there. You've all heard about the Spanish Inquisition. You know what that was basically about? It was about the Catholic Church cleaning up its own, looking for heretics in its own midst. They were not particularly going after Jews, you know, unbelieving Jews, but they were cleaning up their own You know, and some of the people who would later be considered saints and are now honored as saints in the Catholic Church were the objects of that, some of that Inquisition. And they went through a pretty rough time because of it. And even though the popes evidently, supposedly, issued the order that there's to be no torture, torture was used nonetheless. It was used nonetheless to figure out who the heretics were. So that was the object. Who are the heretics among us? We've got to put them to the test and find out. Now the problem is that you had some Jewish converts. What in the world? Why would you have Jewish converts? Quite a few Jewish converts, especially in Spain. Well, most of those, or at least a lot of them, I don't know the percentage, but I would say the majority, were forced conversions. Forced conversions. And they didn't really want to be, but they were. In some cases, the parents had been killed for some reason. And now the children were taken, they were baptized, and said, now you're ours. You know, that's the way it worked. And so you had forced conversions. But, you know, they started to say, wait a minute. Are these folks, are they really Christians now? So they put them to the test. And they would... They would check them by, for example, seeing if they would eat pork. Put them some pork out there. Tell them they had to eat the pork, and if they didn't, you know what that means? You're still a practicing Jew. You're not a good Catholic. And so you got to work on Saturday. If they didn't do it, bad news. And if they were caught hanging around with unconverted Jews or Christianized Jews, then that was bad news as well. And if they were keeping Jewish holidays, if they were keeping Jewish customs or any sign you could find in their houses that that's what they'd been doing, it won't fly. So that, and in some cases they were given a chance to recant, and you know, everything could be restored, but sort of, not really. Let me read a little bit. I want to read from this book. It's a recommended source. It's by, you may be familiar with an evangelical, a Jewish Christian named Michael L. Brown. This is Our Hands Are Stained with Blood. And it goes through, it's a summary of the many things that have happened, especially under the hands of Christians, also the Nazis and many others, to the Jewish people down through the centuries. It's a very, very good, and it's, you know, troubling in some ways, but it's a good book. But anyway, I'd like to read a little bit from what Michael Brown says from page 78. He says, Spain's sins against the Jewish people are great. Although there were church inquisitions throughout Western and Central Europe from the 12th to the 19th centuries, the inquisitions in Spain took on unusually brutal proportions. It is estimated that 30,000 Moronas were burned at the stake in Spanish inquisitions from the 15th century until 1808. In addition to this, in 1492, all non-baptized Jews were expelled from the country. So you see that mercy was given to them. Non-baptized Jews, just get out, we won't bother you, just leave. Yeah. Stripped of their possessions and without any means to defend themselves, the sentence of mass expulsion against these poor souls was virtually a sentence of mass death. Those who converted did not fare much better. They were treated as second-class citizens by other Catholics, and just one wrong move could consign them to the fire. Baptized Jews who wavered but then wanted to be reconciled to the church were subjected to an act of penance called vergüenza. I don't know how to pronounce that. It means shame, shame. They were, and quoting from source Raphael Sabatini in his book on the Spanish Inquisition, he says, they were paraded through the streets, men and women alike, bareheaded, barefooted, and naked to the waist. The procession was headed by a group of monks, followed by the, quoting again, half-naked penitents, cruel physical discomfort being added to their mental torture, for weather was not was so raw and cold that it had been considered expedient to provide them with sandals. Oh, how merciful they were! Lest they should have found it impossible to walk, they held unlit candles in their hands, indicating that they were yet in spiritual darkness. And these are the ones who recanted, who repented now. This is the penance they had to do. And they were marched through the city until they arrived at the cathedral. A chaplain would make the sign of the cross on the foreheads of these Jews, many of whom had been prominent citizens and respected leaders of their city before the Jew hate craze erupted. And then he would recite these words, "Receive the sign of the cross, which you denied and which, being deluded, you lost." And then he goes on to say that after this, a sermon would be preached and the sentence would be announced. And here it is. It says that, here's the quoting again from the same source, they were to be whipped in procession on each of the following six Fridays. Whipped in procession on each of the following six Fridays, being naked to the waist, bareheaded and barefooted, they were to fast on each of these six Fridays, and they were disqualified for the rest of their lives from holding office, beneficence, or honorable employment, and from using gold, silver, precious stones, or fine fabrics. When their six-week penance was completed, they had to give alms to the extent of one-fifth of the value of their property. Now, these are the repentant ones. You know what the ones that didn't repent got? And this is how the church, quote unquote, treated those returned to the fold. And he goes on to tell many, many other horror stories. Let me back up a few pages and read a few. This one section here on all the lies. It's entitled Lies, Lies, Lies. Some things that's unbelievable, but things that actually happen. It says in the 1930, I'm sorry, I keep going to the 1900, but 1348 to 1349, the Black Death ravaged Europe, wiping out about one-third of Europe's entire population. Who was to blame? Well, you know who got the blame. The Jews, of course. The fact that the Black Plague also killed multitudes of Jews didn't seem to bother anyone. Just how did the Jews execute such a wide-ranging plan of destruction? They secretly contaminated the wells with a poisonous mixture made of spiders, lizards, and the hearts of Christians mixed together and the sacred elements of the Lord's Supper. Well, that'll get you every time, won't it? Hundreds of thousands of Christians believe this lie. As a result, thousands of Jews were butchered by angry mobs, and Jewish children under the age of 7 were then baptized and reared as Christians after their families were murdered. That's how they expanded their membership with Jewish converts. What was the proof that the Jews were guilty? Some of them, quote, confessed, unquote, to the crime under severe torture. You know, some people, if you torture people badly enough, taking out, you know, pulling out the fingernails and whatnot, and you do enough to them, some people, just to stop the pain, will say, "Yeah, I did it. Okay, I did it. I did it. I repent." Well, that's what happened. Otherwise, no evidence existed. And of course, obviously, they didn't poison the wells. That's crazy. But anyway. Then there's the charge of desecrating the host. That's the whole, you know what the host is? The host is the Eucharistic wafer that the priest consecrates and supposedly becomes the body and blood of Christ and so on. It says probably the most wide, I won't read that whole section there, it says probably the most widespread anti-Jewish lie that has been told and believed through the ages has been the charge of ritual murder. The story is always the same. A group of Jews kidnap a Christian child, often before Easter, torture him, kill him, often by crucifixion, and more times than not, drink the blood. The remaining blood is also put to good use. The Jews use it for making Passover matzah, unleavened bread. As expected, the only evidence for the crime is always the same. Jews under torture confess. Now, here, this is a typical account, and he's quoting here from Wesenthal's Everyday Remembrance Day. It's on Jewish Martyrs. says, April 26, 1343, a ritual murder accusation is raised against the Jews of Germersheim, however you pronounce that, Germersheim, Germany. Thereupon, the town's whole Jewish community is burned at the stake. The people believed this stuff. I guess the children were all present and accounted for, and yet they still believed that they went out and kidnapped a child, a Christian child, and killed it and used the blood for the way they allegedly did. It says, God only knows how many Jews lost their lives because of this infamous blood libel. The numbers are surely in the multiple tens of thousands. And God only knows how many people, Muslims, atheists, and quote-unquote Christian, believe this lie today. It has been circulating for over 2,000 years. In its early non-Christian form, it was spread by the Greeks and the Romans. So that's been around for a while. It's just gone, you know, adopted by different people over time. It has made its way across the world. A ballad inspired by the Jewish blood libel was recently found in a book of folk songs in the Ozark Mountains in Arkansas, while a booklet published in Birmingham, Alabama, my home state, used to be, in 1962 gave credence to the charge of Jewish ritual murder. So, you know, we could go on and on, and this book does go on and on. And the fact is, Jews have been treated cruelly in many nations, have been murdered, have been forced into conversions, had their children taken away from them, baptized and claimed by the church. They've been driven out of land after land, been hated and despised. And of course, you know, we could go on and on and get into what happened in the Holocaust. Some people deny that, but there's no denying the facts. It really happened. The Holocaust is a reality. It really occurred. There have been efforts to exterminate the Jews from the pages of history, from planet Earth, since time immemorial, and that wasn't just another one of the many. So these things actually happened. Now, again, we could go on and on. The sources are out there and easily accessible. Do some reading, and you'll see that this people have been singled out and persecuted in very vicious ways, terrible ways. Now, as I said earlier, there have been settlements in the land of promise, the land that was promised to Abraham and his descendants all along. But in the last century, I wanted to mention something else before we move on to that. I wanted to mention the fact that, you know, we've been talking mostly about Catholics. The Christianity was, for many centuries, in the West at least, was Catholic. In the East, it was Orthodox, but that was also pretty much the same. But, you know, they were usually busy dying as martyrs' deaths under the hands of Muslims, so they didn't get as big. they did, and under communism, so they didn't. They weren't as active in that regard as the Western Church was. But what about the Protestants, which they came from the Western Church? They came from the Roman Catholic Church. Well, you begin to see a turnaround here in the 1500s. 1523, Martin Luther wrote, "Perhaps I will attract some of the Jews to the Christian faith. For our fools, the popes, bishops, sophists, and monks, the coarse blockheads, have until this time so treated the Jews that if I had been a Jew and had seen such idiots and blockheads ruling and teaching the Christian religion, I would rather have been a sow than a Christian. For they have dealt with the Jews as if they were dogs and not human beings." So before you start hollering hooray for Luther, go get them, you know, Mr. Reformer. Before you do that, let's fast forward 20 years later. And this is after a time when he saw the Jews weren't converting. He didn't see this mass conversion. I wonder why. I wonder why they were hesitant about even considering Christianity. Any guess as to why they might have been so? Might have held back on saying, "I don't know about this." I think there's a pretty good reason. It's because they had a long history of being persecuted, hated, despised, driven out, killed by Christians. That's why. So Luther didn't have any success. He didn't see this mass conversion of Jews. And so when the question was put to him, what shall we Christians do with this damned, rejected race of Jews? Here was his answer. First, their synagogue should be set on fire. Secondly, their homes should likewise be broken down and destroyed. Thirdly, they should be deprived of their prayer books and Talmuds. Fourthly, their rabbis must be forbidden under threat of death to teach anymore. Fifthly, passport and traveling privileges should be absolutely forbidden to the Jews. Sixthly, they ought to be stopped from usury. Seventhly, let the young and strong Jews and Jewesses be given the flail, the axe, the hoe, the spade, the distaff, and the spindle, and let them earn their bread by the sweat of their noses. We ought to drive the rascally, lazy bones out of our system. Therefore, away with them. To sum up, dear princes and nobles who have Jews in their domains, if this advice of mine does not suit you, then find a better one. Get that? Find a better one so that you and we may all be free of this insufferable, devilish burden, the Jews.
Wow.
That's Mr. Reformer himself, Martin Luther. So, the implication there, find a better one. What do you think that possibly meant? How was it taken by, he was the German reformer, later Germans who held him up as somewhat of a hero. And that's not to say anything bad about Germans. Germans are people just like anybody else. But you know what happened in Germany? And certain influences were in place there. This may have been part of it. But again, we could go on and on, and the sources that are out there are easily accessible. You find them on the internet. You find there's many, many books you can read on the subject. This one, as I said, I recommend it. It's quite good. Do some reading, and you'll see that these people have been subjected to persecution, perhaps like no other. They've been especially hated. Forced conversions, expulsions, all the things we talked about. Now, again, as I said earlier, there have been Jewish settlements in the land of promise to Abraham and his descendants all along. The land that was promised to Abraham and his descendants have always had Jewish settlements. But what about the last century? The nation of Israel was reborn, wasn't it? This is just fairly recent history. The nation of Israel was reborn. Some 6 million Jews there today. And it's growing. It's increasing. And I want to comment on this before I go any further, and that's the Khazarian theory. The Khazarian theory, it's out there. If you get on the internet, you'll find it. And that is the false idea that the Ashkenazi Jews, those would be the Western European Jews, the German Jews primarily, the Ashkenazi Jews, the Sephardic Jews is a different group. They're down in Spain. They were the ones expelled from there many times. But anyway, the Spanish Jews and the German Jews primarily. But the Ashkenazi, according to the Khazar theory, they're not really Jews. They're not really descendants of those people who came back from the Babylonian exile. But they are descendants of the Khazars, the Turkic Khazars, or Khazarian kingdom, back in some previous century. Forgot the exact date they pin it to, but centuries ago. And so the Ashkenazi Jews are not Jews at all. The Jews that died in the Holocaust, not real Jews. Now you will find, I was first introduced to that theory, that idea, back when someone gave me some literature. It was actually, as it turns out, as reading through it, I realized what it was. It was a white racist group announced, saying that the Jews, they're not the real Jews. And you will also find the same thing from the so-called black Hebrew Israelites, who are neither Hebrews nor Israelites, claiming that the Jews, the Ashkenazi Jews, are Khazars and not Jews at all. That's false. It's false. I want you to think about this. Just use a little reason, first of all. Given what we've looked at, and just a brief history of the Jews and how they've been treated by virtually every nation under the sun, so many different nations in any case, the cruelty that's been dished out to them. Did somebody in Turkey say, hey, I got a great idea. Let's become Jews. Everybody will like us. That doesn't make sense, does it? Just on the face of it, doesn't make sense. No, I don't think that happened. In fact, there are very good articles, research has been done to address that issue because it keeps coming up. And on linguistic grounds, historical grounds, it does not hold water. Does not hold water. There is no linkage between the ancient Khazarian Empire and the Ashkenazi Jews. There may have been some Jews there, of course, they've been all over the world. But the idea that the Khazarian Empire had a mass conversion to Judaism, didn't happen. You could find it in history if it did. It didn't. And that's on, again, linguistic grounds and historical grounds. But nowadays we have DNA, biological grounds. And guess what? It turns out that the Ashkenazi Jews and the Sephardic Jews and all the other people identified as Jews other than the converts, but those who genetically go back to the fathers, guess what the DNA shows? They all came from the same family. So the Ashkenazi really are Jews. The Sephardic really are Jews. And those people in the land of Israel today are real descendants of the people who came out of the Babylonian exile and resettled the land back then. And the same ones who were there in AD 70 when the Romans besieged the city. It's them. The same people. Again, do they have a right to be there? I say they do. I think they do. Based on the fact that God gave that land to Abraham and his multiple seed, and that promise cannot be annulled by a covenant that was made later. So let's a couple of scriptures before we close in Matthew 23 again. Matthew 23. Again, I'm just going to read verse 39. For I tell you, you will not see me again until you say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. You know, seeing the growth of the Messianic movement in Jerusalem today, like I say, you understand why those things I get more excited about than what pronouncement the Pope made or some German leader might have done. Because it's actually a growing movement. And in other words, it seems that a people are being prepared who will say, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Who'll be prepared to meet the Messiah when he returns. With that in mind, let's go to Romans 11. Romans 11. Romans 11. And let's look at verse 11. Paul says, so I ask, did they, meaning the unconverted Jews, the unbelievers, did they stumble in order that they might fall? Was that the purpose, so that they would fall? By no means. Rather, through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles. You know what that means, of course, as Paul went about, he's speaking from his own experience and the reality that he encountered on a day-to-day basis as he went from town to town, from place to place, over the known world, the world he knew at that time. He went into the synagogues and he found sometimes a good many Jews converted, but it got to where there are not many at all. He was being driven out and rejected by Jews. But guess who was saying, hey, whoa, 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 we want to hear the Gentiles. So because of the rejection, now have those Jews said, yeah, tell us more, let's understand this, let's, he would have spent all the time that they needed. But because he was pushed out more and more, he went to the Gentiles. So that's what he's talking about here. Through their trespass, salvation has come to the Gentiles so as to make Israel jealous. That's very important. To provoke them to jealousy. Now has the Catholic Church or has Christianity in general provoked Israel to jealousy? What this means, in other words, saying, hey, look at what they have. They have the blessings. They have these benefits. They obviously have the Spirit of God resting upon them. I want what they have. I'm jealous. And they start to look into this Messiah thing and find out, lo and behold, did the Catholic Church do a good job of that? Provoking them to jealousy and bringing them to conversion? No, they provoked them to anger. They provoked them to rejection. They provoked them in every way except jealousy and made them want to convert. They made them want to run as far away from as they could possibly get. And the Protestants haven't done much better. Of course, there are Protestant voices today who are very much pro-Israel, and the tide has changed somewhat. But in any case, so as to make Israel jealous, now if their trespass means riches for the world, and if their failure means riches for the Gentiles, how much more will their full inclusion mean? You mean there's a possibility that they will be included? There'll come a time when they might reverse this trend? It's what he's implying here, isn't it? And he goes on to describe how that's to happen. But his vision is that when the conversion of the Gentiles takes place, that the Jews will see that, and they, in time they will begin to realize, says, hey, they're getting the blessings we should have. The Spirit of God is on them. And so it will provoke them to jealousy, and that's what brings them to conversion. But again, the historic church has not done a good job of that, but have done a terrible job. But now, exactly how does this take place? Let's look again. Provoking to jealousy and so forth. Let's look over at verse 28. It says, as regards the gospel, they, meaning the unbelieving Jews, are enemies of God for your sake. Now, some people would stop right there. They're enemies of God. Let's get these Christ killers out. No, look what Paul says, though. They're enemies of God for your sake. But as regards election, they are beloved for the sake of their forefathers. Has the Abrahamic covenant in mind here. God has not forgotten his promise. Will not forget his promise. For the gifts and the calling of God are irrevocable. You can't undo it. It's as clear as that. As simple as that. Just as you were at one time disobedient to God, but now have received mercy because of their disobedience. He's talking to Gentiles. They're meaning the Jews. So they too have now been disobedient in order that by the mercy shown to you, they also may now receive mercy. Again, historic Christianity has done a horrible job of bringing that about. And then back in earlier in chapter 11, verse 25, he speaks of he looks beyond this present, his goal to provoke them to jealousy. He looks beyond that to the end. And this is what he says in verse 25. Lest you be wise in your own conceits, I want you to understand this mystery, brothers. A partial hardening has come upon Israel until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. Until the fullness of the Gentiles has come in. The full number, the fullness, when that's completed, the work to the Gentiles is completed. And in this way, all Israel will be saved. As it is written, the deliverer will come from Zion. He will banish ungodliness from Jacob. And this will be my covenant with them when I take away their sins. So the fullness of the Gentiles, it comes to completion. And then you have this conversion of Jews in a much greater way. Now, I like to think that what we're seeing today in Jerusalem, the fact that it's a nation now, and the fact that we see a growing messianic body there, I like to think that that is a very important prophetically. In fact, I think it may well be linked to something we usually read every year at the feast, and that's back in Zechariah 14. Let's go back there in closing. Zechariah, let's start in the 13th chapter. Zechariah 13. Verse 7, "Awake, O sword, against my shepherd, against the man who stands next to me, declares the Lord of hosts. Strike the shepherd, and the sheep will be scattered. I will turn my hand against the little ones in the whole land, declares the Lord. Two-thirds shall be cut off and perish." That sounds like there's bad news coming for Israel. And he's talking about the land there. "And one-third shall be left alive." In other words, a remnant. A remnant will be preserved. "And I will put this third into the fire and refine them as one refines silver and test them as gold is tested. They will call upon my name and I will answer them. I will say, they are my people. And they will say, the Lord is my God." Who's he talking about? Not Gentiles here. Talking about those people in that land at this time that he's referring to. And then he goes on, "Behold, the day is coming," chapter 14, "for the Lord, when the spoil taken from you will be divided into your midst, for I will gather all the nations against Jerusalem to battle." I can't imagine that happening, can you? I thought all the nations around Jerusalem just loved Jerusalem. They love the Jews, don't they? I don't think so. "And the city shall be taken, and the houses plundered, and the women raped. Half the city shall go into exile, and the rest of the people shall not be cut off from the city. Then the Lord will go out and fight against those nations, as when he fights on a day of battle. On that day his feet will stand on the Mount of Olives that lies before Jerusalem on the east, and the Mount of Olives shall be split in two from east to west by a very wide valley, so that one half of the mount shall move northward and the other half southward. And you," speaking to the remnant, "you shall flee to the valley of my mountains. For the valley of the mountains shall reach to Azel. And you shall flee as you fled from the earthquake in the days of Uzziah the king of Judah. And the Lord my God will come and all the holy ones with him to do battle." That's what he's talking about here. He preserves the remnant and he does battle with the nations who have come against Jerusalem. "On that day there shall be no light, cold, or frost, and there shall be a unique day which is known to the Lord, neither day nor night, but at evening time there shall be light. On that day living waters shall flow from Jerusalem, half of them to the eastern sea and half of them to the western sea. It shall continue in summer as in winter, and the Lord will be king over all the earth. On that day the Lord will be one in his name, one." So this is God's victory at that time. And then, of course, it goes on to tell us that everyone who survives of the nations that came up against Jerusalem will be, as it says, shall go up to do what? Observe one of those Jewish feasts? Are you kidding me? Isn't that the thing we want to get rid of? "Shall come up to observe the Feast of Tabernacles," the Feast of Booths, as this translation says, "to keep the Feast of Booths. And if any family of the earth do not go up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Lord of hosts, there will be no rain on them. And if the family of Egypt does not go up and present themselves, then on them there will be no rain," and so on. They're going to come and keep the Feast of Booths. Now, how is that for a victory when you defeat the nations that come against your city? Your people, you preserve the remnant, you defeat the nations, and obviously people who don't have a lot of love for the Jews. And then you tell them, you have to come up now and keep this feast that's kept in Jerusalem. It may not fly too well at first, but they will get the point that they need to go up and keep the feast. But in any case, there you have it. I do believe that these scriptures, Romans 11, Matthew 23, Zechariah 13, 14, do indicate that you're going to have a very Jewish Jerusalem in the end time. The people will be back in the land. There will be a nation of Israel. It's not all Israel. Most are scattered around the world. We understand that. But there will be a nation of Israel, and there is a remnant in the land, a remnant of believers in the time of the end. Something people may not have thought possible not all that long ago, but now we are seeing it is not only possible, it's happening. It's happening. So perhaps you can see why I get more excited about that sort of thing than I do about speculations about what this nation might do to that nation, the other nation, the Pope, and all that in the mix and in the middle when it comes to looking at things prophetically. So Israel exists. just as the Bible indicates that it would, the nation of Israel, I mean. Jerusalem is the capital of Israel, and there is a remnant in the land this day. Someday the Lord Jesus Christ will return, and they'll be prepared to meet Him and join you and me and all other believers in the great assembly, the true church of God, the true Israel of God, when we rise to meet the returning Christ in the air.